Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Straight from the source tonight, ready to collect. New York's Attorney General is moving in on some of Donald Trump's prized properties, taking her first step to prepare to seize Trump's assets. If he can't put up nearly $500 million by Monday. The Justice Department trying to take a huge bite out of Apple, filing a blockbuster lawsuit accusing the phone maker of keeping hundreds of millions in America reliant on their products. What it could mean for your smartphone. And free falling into chaos. CNN's team sees charred corpses lying in the streets in Haiti as they travel through gang territory with police, while the U.S. evacuates dozens more desperate Americans there. I'm Sarah Seidner in for Caitlin Collins, and this is The Source. Donald Trump only has 4 days left to come up with $464 million. And we now know New York's attorney general is closing in, taking the initial step to seize Trump's assets if he can't come up with the money. Letitia James has filed judgments in Westchester County, just outside New York City. The first indication the state may try to seize Trump's golf course and his lavish private estate known as Seven Springs, a property very dear to the Trump family. This is how the former president's son, Eric Trump, describes it.
We first bought the property in 96. I was about 12, 13 years old at the time, and really my brother and I, and you know, my father during the summers would always put us to work, and we were literally riding mowers around. This is a place that's really special to myself. It's really special to my brother, my father, really the whole family. I mean, this is really our compound.
It could very well be New York State's compound soon. We're talking about a 50,000 square foot mansion nestled in the heart of Westchester County with 60 rooms, including 15 bedrooms, three pools, carriage houses, and servants' quarters. It was built in 1919 by H. J. Heinz of ketchup fame. The property spans more than 200 acres. You may remember hearing Donald Trump himself talk about it before when he bragged about leasing part of the land to late Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi to pitch a tent. Trump says he made a fortune from it.
What did I do with Gaddafi? I leased him a piece of land for his tent. He paid me more than I get in a whole year. And then, he wasn't able to use the piece of land. In one night, more money than I would have gotten all year for this piece of land up in Westchester. Take advantage of a situation.
For a visual, here's what that tent looked like back in 2009. And now in 2024, if Donald Trump can't pay his nearly $500 million fraud fine in just days, it could end up being property of the state. Trump's National Golf Club in Briarcliff, New York, could also be in jeopardy. A judgment has already been entered in New York City, where Trump Tower lies, along with 40 Wall Street and the Trump International Hotel. Things could move very quickly come deadline day. As for Trump, he's still sounding off tonight about the difficulties he's having securing a bond, saying it's flat out impossible to do. I'm joined now by Pulitzer Prize winning journalist David K. Johnson, and also a very good author. You've done a ton of reporting on Seven Springs over the years. Why do you gather this property is basically the first target for the New York AG?
Well, it's unencumbered and along with the golf course, pretty easy to value. You may recall Trump at one point claimed that Seven Springs was worth $291 million. It's worth more like $20 million, or perhaps the one appraisal that said $56 million. If she goes after his apartment in Trump Tower, he will squawk and scream that you're taking my home. And he may do it here. I mean, we should expect Donald Trump and his lawyers will oppose every effort to seize his bank accounts and to sell his properties.
I would imagine just about anyone in that position would try to do the same to try to stop this from happening. But if Donald Trump cannot come up with the bond, which so far he has not been able to do, and he only has a few days left, how would the seizing of properties actually begin? How would it work?
Well, the attorney general would put out liens first, just like someone does work on your home, a kitchen remodel. They may put a mechanics lien on your home. That will prevent any loans or other actions. It also puts the state at the head of the line if Donald Trump decides strategically to file personal bankruptcy in an effort to hold everything off until November 5th. Once the state has liens, it will then seek court orders to sell the properties. And no matter what price they bring, of course, Donald will scream, you're selling it for pennies on the dollar. Well, yeah, it's a fire sale. You had 2 years to arrange your finances because 2 years ago you said you expected this to happen and you didn't get ready for it.
Can you give me some sense, if we just step back here for a second to talk about how unprecedented this is, what would this mean to Donald Trump and his whole persona about wealth to see even one of his properties seized?
Well, Donald's life is his money. Everything about him is wrapped up with his preposterous claims. You know, I'm worth more than $10 billion. I don't need any money from donors to run for president. And so this goes to who Donald is. Donald is his money. He doesn't have any regard for anyone else. We just found out today from a transcript that was made public that when Donald's valet told him someone had been shot and killed during the insurrection, he had no response. Because you and I, we're just objects. We're not human beings. There is no empathy in Donald. We're just objects.
I'm curious what the timeline might be. If he's unable to secure a bond, his attorney has already said they've asked 30 different insurers to help them out, and none of them would take the case. If he's unable to do this by Monday, how soon could the former president lose control of something like Seven Springs or even Trump Tower, for that matter?
Well, right now, of course, he's not in control. The monitor and the independent compliance director are in control. Donald is not allowed to run his business. The bank accounts can be seized very quickly, and that would propose a real problem for Donald. His loans on some of his properties require him to maintain certain bank balances and net worth. So if the state goes in and seizes these bank accounts, he may be in violation of his loans, and then he'll have trouble with lenders that may decide to call the loans.
Wow. I am curious about the cost of these things, because you talked a little bit about, you know, they would go in and they would sell it probably like a fire sale. But are there still mortgages on it? I mean, all of this plays into how much these properties are worth, correct?
That's correct. And mortgage holders will get paid, assuming that the prices here cover that. I mean, one of the ironies of this case, Sarah, is Donald was found to have knowingly, deliberately, persistently inflated the value of his properties. So when something is sold for far less than what he's claimed it's worth, Seven Springs would be a good example. You know, he's going to say, you know, you're cheating me. You know, you're trying to destroy me by not getting the right price. Well, go find your own buyer then, Donald. And he at the end of the day, you know, he's appealing, but there's nothing there for him to win on appeal. No indication. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm a professor of law. That Judge Engoron made any reversible errors. The best Donald might get is the intermediate appellate court might say, well, instead of $354 million before interest, we're going to make it $325. That'll be immaterial to the underlying problem.
So they could lower the bond by a bit, but it would still be a very high number in your prediction. I want to ask you about the monitor that's overseeing the Trump Organization, because today the judge in the case expanded the role of the monitor. Why? What happened?
Well, Donald previously moved money in violation of Judge Engoron's orders, where he's supposed to notify Judge Barbara S. Jones, the retired federal judge who's the monitor. So the new order gives her expansive new powers. It directs that nothing is to be done without her advance knowledge, that requires Trump, his sons, and his employees to cooperate in identifying every bank account, every asset, not making any movements of money without approval. I mean, I don't think the monitor is going to care that they pay the liquor bill for the hotel, but anything beyond routine expenses like that are going to be scrutinized. And the judge, and I think this is very significant, at the end of his order said, if the monitor concludes additional authority is needed, she is invited to come in and ask for that expanded authority.
Wow. David K. Johnston, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. I know you've covered this ad nauseum over the many years, and now we're at a real inflection point. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir.
All right. The presumptive Republican nominee has been furiously posting on Truth Social and firing off campaign fundraising messages, screaming that this is all a witch hunt. Both politically and personally, being short on cash is clearly weighing heavily on a man who for years has defined himself like this.
I know the secrets to making money. I don't know the secrets to a lot of other things, but I know how to make money. And I've always known how to make money.
The old art of the deal, if you'll remember that. Alyssa Farah Griffin was his White House communications director and joins me now. Our reporting Trump is extremely worried about the optics of this. Never mind what happens if they actually go and seize some of these properties, which he has bragged about for years. How bad is this for him as he's going through this?
It's incredibly bad. This is a total blow to the brand of Trump. Trump is as much a brand as he is a businessman, in some ways even more so. I think that's how he was able to get away with inflating his wealth, with being able to secure loans that were completely out of step with what his properties were actually valued at. And you see this. He's been absolutely losing it on social media over these decisions. But what I'm worried about is this. When Donald Trump is backed into a corner, he gets reckless and he makes reckless decisions. This may very well move forward next week and he starts seeing properties taken away from him. Where is he going to turn? There is a possibility he's going to look to foreign, it could be adversaries, it could be individuals within nations that are adversaries, to lend him money if he's not able to secure loans here. And I think that's a very real possibility that folks need to be thinking about in the broader context of this.
That's a really big point that you just said there, and I just want to reiterate, because if you look at who he's bringing back into the fold, trying to bring in people like Paul Manafort, who had millions of dollars that were stored in, you know, foreign accounts all over the place. Do you really think that Donald Trump being pushed to a financial point would reach out to a China or a Russia or...
Donald Trump does not have a moral compass when it comes to America's standing in the world, how we interact with our adversaries, and he certainly puts his interests before the country. So if an oligarch in a Russia or a Chinese business official wants to help him get this money, I have no question that he would end up accepting it.
Wow. All right. As we look ahead, do you think that his money problems will also factor into the politics of all this, which is who his vice president is going to be?
Yeah, because he's got the personal, the business side money problems, which are tremendous. And on top of this, by the way, he's got the E. Jean Carroll settlement, which is another gigantic sum. But he's also not raising money at the clip that he should be. He's using his campaign as essentially a legal defense fund to deal with his multiple cases. On top of that, pair that with an RNC that is not raising money the way it should be. This is wild. Filing today, the RNC has about 11.3 million cash on hand. This time in 2020, when Republicans lost, when Donald Trump lost, they had 77 million. Mm-hmm. There is the Donald Trump factor has been a brand blow to the GOP. People are just not giving. They feel like the money that they're giving is going to his legal battles, not to boosting Republican candidates down ballot. So he could get to a place where he's completely being outraised right now by Joe Biden. He is having to scale back some events. You may see him turn to more earned media, more calling into Fox News, calling into Newsmax, things that don't cost as much money, but it's a very real concern.
I'm curious, do you think that money that is with the RNC, even though it is only $11 million only, that he's going to try to leverage that some way because his daughter-in-law is now one of the people leading the RNC.
Yeah, he's essentially taken over the RNC. He's installed a loyalist and his daughter-in-law is the co-chair. He's taken out a lot of staffers and put in ones who he believes are loyal to him. So I think he's always sort of seen it as his slush fund and even the way he hoped the RNC would engage in the primary on his behalf. So you should assume that money is going to go as much as possible to Trump and not to down-ballot Republican candidates.
When you look at his financial situation, we've been hearing different things from the campaign that they are trying to scale back, choose different venues. They're stopping rallies in some places and going in other places. Can he win the election if he's not spending a lot? Because if you look at the polling, Biden has a ton of money in comparison, but the polls are showing that Donald Trump is still up.
There are so many crazy dynamics about this election. One being Nikki Haley, who's no longer in the race, has more cash on hand than the RNC does, $11.5 million right now.
That's wild.
But Republicans decided not to nominate her. Donald Trump is struggling. Joe Biden is outraising him nearly more than two to one at this point. But Donald Trump is unlike any living politician I've seen. He commands media attention. He can take over a news cycle with one statement, and he's going to lean into that. It's kind of how he ran in 2016. They weren't spending money. It was he was appearing in earned media. He was calling into networks, and everyone had to cover every word he said. So he's got a plan in his back pocket if he can't do his giant rallies because they're simply too expensive.
He's got his own social media thing that he's constantly pumping out. I know they send tons of emails. We all get them. And so they're reaching out in all different ways. It isn't that expensive.
Yes,
it seems to be
but
working.
This is all very bad for other Republican candidates winning who rely on the RNC. They rely on the presidential candidate to fundraise for them, and he simply can't.
Pay for ads and all the like. Mm-hmm. Alyssa Farah Griffin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, just ahead. The DA, who narrowly avoided disqualification on Trump's election case in Georgia, is now pressing ahead with her goal to put the former president on trial before Election Day. Exclusive reporting, that's coming up next. And the dark side of kids' TV exposed in a new docuseries featuring former Nickelodeon child stars. One of them from the show Zoe 101 is here with her story.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
The district attorneys in both of Donald Trump's state criminal cases making pushes tonight to try and get those trials back on the calendar. In Manhattan, DA Alvin Bragg says April 15th is enough time for the Trump team to go over thousands of documents just recently turned over to them. While in Georgia, Fulton County DA Fani Willis, fresh off the fight to stay on the case and facing her own political primary fight in May, is planning to ask the judge for a summer start. Shan Wu is a former federal prosecutor and joins me now. Shan Wu, so good to see you. I want to start with the Fulton County District Attorney. She's been asking for an August start date for this trial for months. I think back in November was the first time we heard August 5th as a trial date. The judge didn't respond to her request in November. Is there any chance of this actually happening in August now?
I think it's very hard, especially because the judge, McAfee, has not chosen to set the trial date. He didn't stay the case while he gave permission, which I don't think he should have given permission for this appeal in the meantime. But he can do some of the work in getting the case ready for trial. But if he doesn't set that trial date, I mean, there's only so much that Fani Willis can do. And even if they're ready to go, which they may well be, I just think it makes it very, very hard to get it done.
What is he waiting for? I mean, what hurdles does the DA still need to face to try to get the trial going by the summer?
I don't think there's any hurdles within the case or legally. I mean, he could just go ahead and set the trial date. If something happens, you know, something happens. But there's no reason, if he's serious about trying to get the case done quickly, then he should just set the trial date. Obviously, the Supreme Court's immunity ruling, you know, could upend the apple cart if that happens. But nothing stops him from setting a trial date. So I think it's a real mistake for him not to do that.
And so often, as you and I both know, that those dates get moved anyway. They get
right.
Postponed and changed constantly. Let's go now to the hush money trial in New York. The Manhattan DA wants to get it started by April 15th. Is that likely?
That's also hard, although in that case, for different reasons, there's a little bit of a convoluted backstory here, but all these documents got turned over, it really, you can trace that back to the Southern District of New York being slow about producing some of these documents, and then it made its way to the defense. It's not an overwhelming number of documents. In a day and age where we're dealing with electronic discovery, you have terabytes worth of documents, but it's sufficient that they have a leg to stand on to say, hey, we need some time. And more importantly, within those documents, they might find issues for other kinds of motions, other things that might delay it. So I think it's hard. It's not impossible, but it is hard. And if you asked me to choose between the two, I'd say it's more likely for Bragg's case to go than it is for the Fulton County one.
So you think the New York case may go quicker, but maybe not April 15th. I want to talk about the reason why the New York trial was delayed, and it's because the DOJ was late in handing over records about Michael Cohen. We're learning now that those records come from the Mueller investigation, which was done 5 years ago now. Why all the delays in getting all this stuff where it needs to be?
Well, it's hard to say. I've rhetorically asked why DOJ was generally kind of late with looking at the Trump and higher up investigations. Took a long time to appoint Jack Smith. There can be reasons internally why one prosecutor's office doesn't like to turn over information from their investigation. They may be thinking, we might still want to do something with this. We don't want someone else to mess it up with what they're going to use it for. And traditionally, there has been a little bit of a competitive tension between the Southern District of New York and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. So that may have played into it as well.
That's an interesting point. Shan Wu, it's always a pleasure to see you. Thank you so much.
Good to see you.
All right, coming up next, the U.S. government is now suing Apple, accusing the tech giant of illegally monopolizing the smartphone market, what it could mean for millions and millions of iPhone users, perhaps even you. A blockbuster antitrust lawsuit by the Department of Justice is accusing Apple of illegally monopolizing the smartphone industry, saying you, the consumer, is being hurt by their practices. Attorney General Merrick Garland today rattling off a laundry list of Apple's alleged anti-competitive conduct when it comes to the iPhone, including the so-called green bubble divide.
If an iPhone user messages a non-iPhone user in Apple Messages, the text appears not only as a green bubble, but incorporates limited functionality. The conversation is not encrypted, videos are pixelated and grainy, and users cannot edit messages or see typing indicators. As a result, iPhone users perceive rival smartphones as being lower quality because the experience of messaging friends and family who do not own iPhones is worse.
Apple firing back in a statement today telling CNN, quote, this lawsuit threatens who we are and the principles that set Apple products apart in fiercely competitive markets. Joining me now tonight, CNN senior data reporter Harry Enten, speaking of fiercely competitive, and as it turns out, an Android user. We have fought over this phone for so long. Mm. I'm not gonna go after you like I normally do. But you're a green bubble guy.
I am.
I'm an iPhone user. Mm-hmm. How often are you getting shamed by us? Because I know I come after you like pretty much daily.
You're not the only one who comes after me daily. You know, earlier on, I was visiting with our dear friend Phil Mattingly, who everyone thinks is this nice guy.
He is
a nice guy, except when it comes to this. He was shaming me. I'm in a group chat with him and Mark Preston, of course, who's a VP here, and they're always going, Harry, what is going on here? The videos are so grainy. The pictures are so grainy. You have this green bubble that's going on. It honestly makes me feel a little self-conscious about myself, Sarah. And, you know, that's why I'm here right now, to tell folks on national TV that it
nice.
Is to be nice and it is okay. And those kids out there as well, a lot of them are actually getting teased in their groups.
That is true.
And they actually take it personally. For me, it bounces off of me like nothing else. But for those kids, it's actually a pretty big deal.
Yeah. For you, it's a little bit of a first world problem. Let's just be honest about that.
Yeah.
The DOJ in this lawsuit is basically accusing Apple of creating toxic ecosystems of devices that really only work with other Apple devices. So Apple phone to your Apple computer.
Yeah.
And everything else is problematic.
It is.
Correct?
Exactly right. You know, so, you know, I mentioned the Droid here, right, the Android here, but I also happen to work on an Apple computer, right? So I work on this Apple computer, and trying to sync these two up is very difficult. It's very difficult. I actually have to use a different message chat in which I have an iMessage chat that goes to my Gmail in order to chat with other people on my computer versus my girlfriend who has the exact opposite sort of problem going on where she has an iPhone but a Windows computer, and trying to sync that up, it's very difficult to get actually in touch with her because she can't get her messages on her Windows computer during the day. And so she's trying to go, what? And it just becomes this entire cascading problem where it just becomes, look, it's not impossible, Sarah.
Right.
It's just inconvenient to the matter of fact, that it could be you go, forget about this. I'm going to drop my Android device. Or I'm going to drop my Windows computer. In some ways, they're creating vertical integration going on here, right? And trying to assume or trying to get it so that you have to buy an Apple product in each of the different ways you might, in fact, use technology.
What say you about Apple, which can argue, look, we're just doing good business. Like, we came up with all these different things, and this is how good business runs.
Well, I guess it depends what you believe is good business, right? If you look at the stock price, then Apple's doing very good business. Since the iPhone came out, you know how much Apple's stock is up? It is up, get this, 4,544%. I don't care what language you speak. That is a very high percentage. If you look at the percentage of folks who are using an iPhone in the smartphone market, it's basically more than doubled over the last decade. And of course, the iPhone only came out in the late 20-aughts. So all of a sudden, Apple, which was this one company that was really known mostly for using and making computers, all of a sudden was able to jump into the smartphone market and dominate that market. And now most folks who you know, associate Apple with a product, they don't associate it with a laptop such as this. They associate it with a phone such as your own.
Right. It's a full computer in your hands and a television station and many other things. But if this lawsuit is actually successful, what does it mean for Apple products? What happens?
Yeah, so what does it mean for Apple products? Well, first off, it could mean the easier cross-messaging, right? So all of a sudden, maybe I wouldn't be ostracized for using this particular
phone.
It'll
be blue now?
May be blue, or maybe it'll be some new color. Who even knows?
Right.
Maybe it'll be purple. It could also mean lower outside developer fees, right, for essentially trying to create different applications. It could allow for competitor application stores, right, because at this particular point, if you're trying to, you know, get something on this computer, you have to go to the Apple or the Mac App Store. And it could also allow for more digital wallets. Now, I, of course, am not somebody who really understands what a digital wallet is. You can see right here, this is my actual wallet.
That's your Costanza wallet. What you're into.
This is my Costanza wallet. I don't know what I don't know the exact usefulness for a digital wallet, but the fact is you can't really use anything outside of the Apple products on your digital wallet right now. That's an Apple digital wallet. So they're trying to essentially say, if this is in fact successful, you have to allow for more competition there.
People that are into crypto will care about the digital wallets.
They will,
I guarantee you. Harry Enten, always a joy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Get a different phone.
Yeah, maybe.
All right. Thank you, Harry.
Thanks.
To the horror in Haiti, where violent gangs are attempting to take over the country, and the battle to stop them is growing more dire and more difficult. One of our reporters in the middle of it all joins us next.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish. So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protest that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Descending into complete chaos. In Haiti's capital, there is no food and water getting in, no fuel, and no way out as the port and roads remain blocked. The streets of Port-au-Prince are filled with smoke and occupied by violent gangs, and police are overrun and overwhelmed. Journalist and Haitian pro-democracy and social justice advocate Monique Kleska joins me now from Port-au-Prince. Thank you so much for being here. You are there in Port-au-Prince. Give me some sense of how safe you are at this point, and are you able to leave your home, for example?
No, and I'm not alone. Most people do not leave their home unless it's absolutely necessary. And the last 4 days have been absolutely, you know, just terrifying. A Sunday night, there was a massacre. 13 people were shot by one person. Monday, my neighborhood was overrun by gangs. Tuesday, it was also in Pétionville in another area. Yesterday also. So it is everywhere. And today there was a big, huge battle in the center of town. But I think one of the things that is important amongst all this chaos, I think it's important to say that we are resisting in different ways. It may be small ways that are not at the level of the chaos and the assault that we are feeling from the gangs. But I think it's important to note that the police killed a gang leader yesterday. So that was important. Today also, they killed a gang leader. And astonishingly, both of them were freed from the jailbreak recently. And so neighborhoods are organizing, they are putting barricades, WhatsApp groups to let you know what's going on. And so there is some organization, and the police is also, the population worked with the police in the two cases of the gang leaders that were killed. So I think that resistance merits some attention. We are not just sitting down taking it, but we are fighting in small ways, but in ways that are important. And in ways that I say are Haitian, you know?
Yeah, it really is important to show that there is some kind of community action to try and get the country back in any way possible. And if not the whole country, at least a neighborhood. Can you give me some sense of how difficult it is for you to get food and water and for the population to get food and water who are dealing with this in the middle of Port-au-Prince?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I had difficulties getting water. I got water. Fortunately, I live in a semi-rural area where there are farms. So the farmers market opens, but really very, not everybody's there. Not all the sellers are there. And they go home quickly. So one has to be there. And so I did go out for 1 hour. On Tuesday after the assault to get things like toilet paper, etc. But it really was a feeling of everybody was just rushing, everybody was nervous, everybody was on edge, and I even saw bodies by the side of the road. So it is a hellish kind of situation, really very, very difficult.
It is so disturbing to hear you talk about you go out for 1 hour just to get the things that you need to stay alive, and you see bodies in the road just laying there. It's horrific to see what is happening to the people of Haiti. I do want to ask you about the politics of Haiti. The Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, says that he will resign, but there is a caveat that he'll only do so when there's a transitional presidential council. How does that even begin to happen with the chaos that exists right now in the capital?
Well, believe it or not, they are working. They're working about 20 hours out of 24. And I think one thing that is extraordinary is these are people who normally would not be sitting together, but they are doing it, even though a lot of it is being done by Zoom. Almost all of it is being done by Zoom, by Google Meet and whatever, because nobody can move. But there is action. They are trying to work to get together this provisional council. And they are working on three specific things also. One of them is the accord itself. What will it entail? Another one is the organization and how they will work together. And the third one is a roadmap for the first 100 days. So they are moving forward with that. Now, how many, and I think there is a game that's being played, perhaps with CARICOM and the U.S. government, how many will be in it? Before it was seven, and then there were two observers, and then it's moving, and then one group was out, and then one group is in. So that is a game that is being played, and I believe they are asking for a CARICOM face-to-face meeting because they have not met with CARICOM since last Monday. So that is important.
That is very
important.
So we
are hopeful that they will come to a decision, they will come to an agreement so we can get out of this. And then starts the hard work in terms of pacifying, in terms of getting
security.
People to even step out of their house, security,
yeah.
And justice also, because we need justice.
Monique, I thank you for explaining what is happening there to you and to the other people of Haiti as you deal with this really, really, really difficult situation and chaos there. I appreciate your time and your expertise. I want to go now to CNN's David Culver. We have a reporter who is on the ground in Haiti. He and his crew risking themselves to try and bring us these stories. David, you've been on an extremely dangerous trip into gang territories. Give us some sense of what you saw.
Hey there, Sarah. Yeah, we were embedded with the Haitian National Police, and I'm going to show you some of those images in just a moment. But I want to go back to something Monique just said, and she referenced being out for about an hour in the middle of the day and seeing bodies. She is by no means exaggerating. Here's a sampling of what we have seen just in the past 24 hours.
What I'm looking at right now here on the streets of Port-au-Prince is too disturbing to show you in full, but it's the charred remains of a body sitting in the middle of a very busy street here in the morning rush hour. And this is part of these extrajudicial killings, essentially the community taking justice into their own hands when they believe that there is a suspected gang member or somebody that has any ties to gangs, maybe even an advanced member who's trying to get some intelligence. If they suspect that person is in their community at the wrong time and in the wrong place as they see it, they will take action. But it's also just become the reality when police are so short-staffed, their resources are strained, and they don't have the ability to enforce law. So it falls on folks in the neighborhoods to do it themselves. And you can even see here, look at this, a police car is just going right past and it'll continue on. It doesn't even stop.
That is just remarkable.
One of four bodies, Sarah, that we have seen charred remains in the past couple of days here. Yeah, it's really difficult to see. You also saw that we were embedded with police. That was in gang territory, as you mentioned. That was a police operation that happened in that same area just a few hours after we left. And we do know that it has ended with several gang members dead, but police struggling to hold the line, Sarah.
David Culver, I got to tell you, those pictures of just a charred body in the street with people just driving by like there's nothing to see there, nobody moving the body, nobody taking it anywhere to be buried, really, really disturbing. Thank you so much to you and your photographer, Avelio, who I know is with you. All right, a new documentary on alleged abuse on the sets of some of the most popular children's shows at Nickelodeon. A former child star from Zoe 101 with her story coming up next.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.